How has the tour gone?
It's been very good. We got off to a bit of a slow start, mainly because of technological problems. But
right.
You know, with Cleveland being the hub of the music industry, it was important for us to iron out those last-minute details. So, you know, the start of the tour and everything. So we just felt it was best to postpone that and I suppose a bit like a Led Zeppelin reunion, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Which they cancelled their first thing, whether it was
right.
because of Jimmy Page's damaged finger, I don't know.
Right, that's true.
But, you know, I suppose, you know, in retrospect, we could have done the show, but I think we made the right decision because we came back and we played a killer show, you know?
Yeah, I saw the April 8th show at Nokia. And I reviewed it for the website, and I just loved it. I thought it was presented in a unique way.
Oh, thank you.
With the studio feel and the audience participation. Was that your idea or Greg's idea or both of you?
Well, it was actually Greg's idea. I mean, of course, we were going to do... Originally, it was sort of planned to be unplugged. And then... Well, we do use some technology now, but at the very beginning, we were really kind of, it was just guitar and the piano. And I suggested to Greg, you know, how about the stage setting? It's like a living room,
yeah.
You know, with just sort of like a lampshade or something and a couple of armchairs. And we just sort of relaxed like that. And... Greg sort of came back to me and he said, well, no, that's sort of, he said, well, he, at first he liked the idea, but then he called me back and he said, it's a good idea, he said, but I don't really like the idea of armchairs and lamps and things, he said, because although we are in the autumn of our years, we don't want to harp on that sort of casual old boy sort of attitude. He said, I've got an idea, what about that we create a studio? And we have actually the our sound mixer is in the control room. And I said, "Oh, yeah, that's a nice idea. I like that." So, yeah, that was Greg's idea. And then of course it went a bit further. And you know, with all the facade was being built, and I'm going, "Oh God, you know, have we got the budget for this?" You know. So that was a concern, but the management sort of put their heads together and said, "Yeah, okay, you know." So
no, I loved it.
A lot of people have commented on that it's a very warm sort of atmosphere, really.
And both of your playing was fantastic, and I also love the anecdotes about Leonard Bernstein and Dave Brubeck, really interesting stories, too.
Oh, yeah, well, that's lovely. I'm glad you appreciate that. Yeah.
Oh, definitely, yeah. They were major influences. I mean, Brubeck was at an early age, right, in terms of...
Yeah, no, he's a lovely guy. I admire him so much. He was, it was the first record I ever had. It was Dave Brubeck's Take Five. It was a single, and on the B-side was Blue Rondo a la Turk. And I never thought I'd actually, you know, I mean, I wasn't, I was playing, of course, but I was having sort of classical lessons at, you know, I guess I was probably about 15 when I had that first record. And I never thought at that time that I'd actually be playing that the B-side of that record, let alone, you know, meeting the great man himself, you know.
Yeah.
So it was quite an amazing experience. I'd have never have dreamt that back when I was 15 years old.
Oh, yeah, and he was recently honored, Kennedy Center honor. It was well-deserved, well, for him, really.
Yes, yes.
In addition, Robert Moog recently passed away. How did you first meet him, and what was your initial thoughts about his synthesizer? I mean, it shaped your sound live, but your initial encounter with him?
Yeah, well, I originally walked into a record store in London, and the guy knew me. I think it was around about 1968, and he played this record of Walter Carlos, Switched on Bach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I said, what's making the music? So on the cover was the picture of this. He said it's called a Moog synthesizer. I went, wow, I've got to see if I can get hold of one of them. So there was actually a musician in England, in London, by the name of Mike Vickers.
Mm-hmm.
And he had one. So I managed to get his number and go over to his house and have a look at it. And I actually used it. He loaned it to me for one concert that I did. And I was so impressed with it that when I formed ELP, I called up the company and asked to get one. I tried to get one for nothing at first, but they said, well, seeing as the Rolling Stones, the Beach Boys, and the Beatles have bought theirs, we see no reason why you shouldn't buy yours. So that was it.
And they used it on record first, right? Earlier on recordings?
Well, Bob Moog actually designed it for use only in the studio.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, and then you
studio use,
but you applied it in a live setting and in just an incredible way.
Yeah, I was brave enough to take it on the road, and of course, you know, it is a. I was kind of like a test pilot with it, really, I suppose, and still am, you know, because it can go out of tune, and you just really have to, you know. Really work with it when it's on stage, but it just has such a unique sound with all the analog, and it's got so much more depth than what digital keyboards have today.
Yeah, you were getting some amazing sounds out of it at the Nokia that night. Incredible. The talk of the classic rock world, though, is your reunion with the other two members of Emerson, Lake and Palmer, at the High Voltage Festival.
That's correct.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you think it's hard to live up to the legacy that your band has, incredible legacy, timeless legacy, in terms of performance there?
Is it hard to live up to it?
Yes.
I don't really sort of, put myself on any sort of pillar or anything and go, wow, you know, this, you know, I mean every show it's like I'm playing it for the first time,
right?
So, you know, I'm not, I suppose, you know, after the shows and we get to meet the audiences and it's there's quite a lot of adulation, you know, it's I still don't really allow it to affect me, so I don't really think of legacies or anything like that, you know.
Well, yeah, that's true. Well, the fans look at it as a tremendous legacy, you know, iconic bands.
That's lovely, yes.
Yeah, iconic bands in history. Are you looking forward to that experience, that concert?
It's going to be a mega event. I have a little bit more of a more confident feeling about it. And I'm not saying that I never doubted that it would be. But I mean, who knows? Festivals can be absolutely chaotic.
Right. You guys played the Isle of Wight way back.
Well, we did the Isle of Wight. You know, that was pretty chaotic. We were lucky enough to get off the island. You know, but
and that was your second show, right? Is that true? That was your second show ever, like in
front
of a
live audience?
Yeah,
that's right. Our first was in Plymouth.
Wow.
That's correct, yes.
Incredible.
So. Yeah.
I recently listened to Emerson on by Emerson, and just really just fantastic recording.
Oh, thank you.
Creole Dance, Outgoing Tide, Cajun Alley. I mean, it's really, really wonderful, wonderfully done.
Thank you.
Any thoughts on the making of that?
My manager Stuart Young contacted, or actually I think it was Sony Classical record label, who were trying to find new ways of there's only so many Beethoven Fifth Symphonies you can keep releasing with different orchestras until everybody says, well, we know how that goes, you know. So Sony Classical were looking for a new dimension. And as most of the classical orchestras today are looking for new repertoire, and I'm very fortunate that my piano concerto is being performed by lots of different symphony orchestras and
yes.
classical pianists. Mm-hmm. And also recently in Tokyo, Tokyo Symphony just did Tarkus, actually.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. Also, is it true that recently a number of young musicians have performed Pirates, Young Person's Orchestra?
Sorry, say again?
A number of young musicians performed Pirates, I heard, Young Person's Orchestra of Brazil.
Yes, I've seen clips of that on YouTube.
It's amazing how the music just has affected so many people, and all these different people paying homage in this way.
Yeah, it is lovely. Yeah,
really, really nice. Just a couple more. In recent years, you reformed the Nice before the passing of Brian Blinky Davison. What are your thoughts about Brian and his legacy?
Brian Davison's style was extremely unique, and I mean, he had this sort of very sort of bopping, cheeky sort of style, which was very endearing and very suited to the sort of things that I was experimenting with at that particular time. I look back on the Nice with particular fondness, and Lee Jackson is my long-standing friend, and he still is. I'm still in contact with him, and he's...
That's nice.
It was lovely going back on the road with them. It was actually a suggestion of the promoter, Harvey Goldsmith. And I said, well, if I'm going to do this, I'd like to augment the band. He said, well, yeah, no problem. So I had to have the original members in. I wouldn't have done it without them, because the Nice, as far as I'm concerned, is myself, Lee Jackson, and Brian Davison.
Yes. Incredible. Great, great band. Great progressive band. One of the early progressive bands, I would say.
Yes.
With Atomic Rooster. Just amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Very, very good. Your movie soundtrack work is so impressive. Particular favorite of mine is Nighthawks, but, Godzilla. Just amazing. When you do that work, what is the process like? Do you have a musical concept in mind, or do you sit and watch a film frame by frame?
In the case of Nighthawks, I was given the script first, and then I was given some outtakes of the actual shooting, the film. I came up with the main title theme, and Universal flew me to L.A., and there I met Stallone, and... He liked it from the word, he liked my music, my approach from the word go, which was quite an amazement. I'd had some experience. I'd only done one major film prior to that, and that was Inferno.
Yes.
For Dario Argento in Italy.
Right. You attended a screening in October 17th of it, I had read, last October, or...
What's that, sorry?
You attended a screening of Inferno? On October
17th,
yes, I think,
I read somewhere. And the actress, Ari Miracle, was there.
Wow.
That was quite fun. Dario didn't Dario Argento didn't show up.
How much input does the director have on the direction the music goes in? Any, or it's really more of your decision in terms of...
Mm.
Is there any input by...
There is, of course... depends where you're working. When I was working with Dario Argento in Italy, I mean, he didn't really interfere at all. If he did, I didn't understand what the hell he was talking about, because he didn't speak English.
That's great.
But in Hollywood, you get there's tons of people that try and sort of put their two pennies worth in,
Yeah, very interesting. You had a cyst removed from your right hand in 88, a fracture in 90, an operation on a nerve in 93. I'm amazed. I saw you play. I can't see how it's affected you, but how was it coming back from that, all of that?
It was hellish. I mean, I was actually told I'd never play again, but...
From which one? From the nerve?
Well,
or?
I don't know. I started having pianistic problems, which I suppose really were... Well, actually, I've learnt now. It came from my neck after a whiplash injury of a motorcycle accident.
Oh, wow.
And the ulnar nerve starts from the neck, and it goes all the way down, either one of your arms, really, can do. So I'd had a number of EMGs and, you know, electronic tests, and they said, well, your right arm is a bit lower than your left, and you need an ulnar nerve transposition, which the ulnar nerve is in where your funny bone is in your elbow.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, you know, in retrospect, I needn't have had that done. I think if I'd have just really consistently gone to a chiropractor and had my neck adjusted, it would probably have eased up. You know, and certain relaxation techniques, which I could have employed, might have alleviated the problem. But back then, it was some surgeon in California, who I deeply regret having had surgery, and that was it, you know.
Well, you sounded great. I mean, when I saw you, so it really doesn't seem to have affected it too much. But Clark Peart is such a shining moment for music, in my opinion. But in terms of musicianship and song creativity and performance.
Why was it such a shining moment?
Unless you... Yeah.
Well, I think people in general get tired of the average sort of like pop tune, you know. And, you know, it's, and they just want something that they can really, you know, rather than listening to classical music, you know, get some more depth out of it, you know, whereas, you know, I suppose everybody in their musical tastes goes through the pop sort of angle.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yes.
Some people just that really don't listen to music at all. They're just, you know, they're not interested in it. But those that do go beyond that point want something of substance, and I think that you know, it's great that they come up with that sort of thing.
Yes, and with Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and other projects you've done, the influences from so many different forms of music are present in your playing, which is just incredible. Classical influence, jazz, it's just a hybrid of everything.
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you foresee in terms of the collaboration between you, Greg, and Carl, in terms of any chance of any recording, extended tours after that, or it's too soon to really say?
Well, I know that Carl has got his own commitments with his band, and I've also got my band. I think Greg and myself would probably want to, you know, further the duo issue. We haven't had a chance to really speak with Carl because he's been very busy with other bands, you know. But I'm sure if things start going very well for us and there is that opportunity and we can put our calendars together, that it would be silly to ignore such a good thing, you know.
I agree.